Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, we look at efforts to increase access to healthy foods for San Francisco residents. Against the backdrop of the city's vibrant food and restaurant culture, nearly one quarter of San Francisco's residents don't have reliable access to fresh, nutritious food, despite the city's commitment to social equity. Supervisor Eric Marr has referred to food access as a civil rights issue. To tackle this problem, organizations including the Department of Public Health and UCSF have teamed up to create innovative ways to expand healthy food access. What is the scale of so-called food insecurity here and across the country? And what are the hidden costs to society of having so many people not knowing where their next meal is coming from? And what are scalable and sustainable ways to reverse this problem? Well, to discuss these questions with me tonight in the studio are Dr. Paula Jones. She is Senior Health Planner and Director of Food Systems at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Dr. Hillary Seligman. She's Director of EATSF, a program we'll hear about more later in the program, and also Associate Professor of Medicine at UCSF and the Center for Vulnerable Populations. And she's also a practicing internist at San Francisco General Hospital. Welcome, Hillary.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Eli Zegas, and he is Food Systems and Urban Agriculture Program Manager at SPUR. Welcome, Eli.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Yes, and to remind our listeners, I am a faculty member at UCSF and also a employee of the San Francisco Department of Public Health, but my appearance here tonight is independent of my affiliations with those two organizations. And we, of course, invite you, our listeners, to join in with your questions and comments in this hour as we talk about a very important topic in this season of giving, as it were. And we'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. You can dial 415-841-4134 to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And you can also email us now or text us, actually, as well at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at the KALW website. So, Eli Zegas with SPUR, I wanted to start with you. I know that SPUR is coming out with a report on this issue. Tell us about the scope and how you understand food insecurity.
Sure. I think, as Hillary and Paula can speak in more detail, a huge issue in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. And you can see that in a couple different statistics. It depends which ones you want to look at. The UCLA does a survey across California, and from that we know that 1 in 10 adults report being food insecure, that they're not able to get the food they need for a nutritious 3 meals a day, sort of what you would expect to have in a day. If you look at it based on income, there are a number of different measures, and the California poverty measure, it's 1 in 4 residents say that you would think in San Francisco can't afford healthy food.
So say more about that, because that's a pretty shocking statistic, 1 in 4 people.
Yeah. The cost of living here, as the listeners know, is very high. And because of that, people are having to make choices about what they spend their money on. And often housing is going to come before food. And so people are making choices, and many of them decide that they can't get all the food they need. They've got to go with housing. They've got to go with transportation. And it leads to food insecurity.
So what kind of choices are people up against here? When you said housing versus food, but when they're looking at food specifically.
Sure. I mean, if you don't have a lot of money, you're going to go for calories. You're going to go for things that are shelf-stable and last a long time, and that ends up being more processed food and less healthy food because often the healthiest food doesn't last very long. Your dairy, your vegetables. And so you're going to go for what fills you up and what lasts a long time, and that's rarely part of a healthy diet.
And I imagine those healthier foods are more expensive?
They can be. It's also that they might go bad. And so, you know, it's a bit riskier to buy it if you're not sure you're going to use it right away. And so you run the risk of spoilage. You can make a healthy diet on a lower budget, but we have a whole national food system that subsidizes things, so it makes processed food often cheaper. So lots of calories without much nutrition is lower priced than, say, higher nutrients with calories.
Mm-hmm. And so expense is one potential issue. How about actual access to those foods? So maybe the prices aren't that much different,
sure.
but how easy is it for for most people, or especially the people that say they have a hard time accessing healthy foods. What's the problem there? Why can't they find those foods?
Yeah,
if price is not necessarily the issue.
Right. I think you're hitting right on it. It comes down to, can you find the food? Can you afford the food? And then do you choose it? Do you know what's healthy and makes a healthy diet? And through that survey I mentioned before, we know that 1 in 10 people in the Bay Area report that they have difficulty finding food. But of those, it's closer to 1 in 6 who have difficulty affording fruits and vegetables in their neighborhood. And it's data that shows that the affordability is a bit more of a hurdle than finding it. Now, it depends on what neighborhood you're in. Certainly, there are places where it's much more difficult in San Francisco to find fruits and vegetables and other healthy food. But the affordability, and I think the EDSF program gets at this, is really one of the biggest barriers. Sometimes it's finding it, but oftentimes it's affording it is the barrier.
What else did your investigations find?
Well, I think the reason to care about food access is three reasons. One is basic hunger. In a city as wealthy as San Francisco, we shouldn't have people going hungry and being food insecure. Second is the health implications, and both Paula and Hillary can speak to that much better than I can. And then third is a quality of life. Should people in one neighborhood, San Franciscans in one neighborhood, have to travel significantly farther than another to find fresh fruits and vegetables to have a healthy diet? And for all those reasons, we think it's important for policymakers to care about food access. And I think the efforts that we're going to be talking about tonight are trying to address all three of those, and food is the approach. Hmm.
So turning next to you, Paula Jones, from the San Francisco Department of Public Health, let's bring discussion a little bit more local to San Francisco. Tell us about what you found in terms of different neighborhoods and different demographic groups in terms of this concern.
Yes, in last year, the Food Security Task Force, which I'm a member of and also Hillary's a member of, and that's a public-private partnership that is authorized by the Board of Supervisors. We did an assessment of food security in San Francisco and found that there is food insecurity all across the city. There's concentrated food insecurity in particular neighborhoods and among particular population groups. So, for instance, in the Tenderloin, that is a neighborhood which has high poverty, many children in poverty, many adults with disabilities, many seniors, and we have higher rates of utilization of free dining rooms in that neighborhood. We also found that there is a lack of access in other neighborhoods like Bayview, Hunters Point, Ocean View, some of these areas that have been it comes through some of our analyses. And then with the population groups, one of our challenges, we actually used a framework that we had adopted from the World Health Organization to really look at this issue. And food security rests on three pillars. We adapted it, this framework a little bit, but one is having the financial resources to purchase food, which Eli has talked about. One is having food in that's close to you, whether it's a food program in your neighborhood or whether it's a grocery store in your neighborhood, something that is convenient to you is important. And then the last issue we looked at is really, we termed it consumption, and really this the know-how around how to prepare food and also the ability to prepare food. And what we found, especially that was interesting, I think, was that for sure many people lack the resources, and that is, as Eli said, because of the cost of living. And the resources could come from the money you earn, the money you're getting on a fixed income. It could come from federal nutrition programs like food stamps or SNAP, CalFresh, WIC. And food access, we looked at many different programs from the school meal program to free dining rooms to senior meal sites. And then for the consumption, what we really looked at was the number of housing units without kitchens. And that's where we really saw a concentration of that in the Mission, in Tenderloin, and in Chinatown. So all of these things, it's a much more complex issue, and it's very difficult sometimes to quantify, but we tried to collect many different indicators and put it through this framework, And then we also organized the information by supervisorial district so that we were able to give particular information to each member of the Board of Supervisors and the neighborhood groups so that they would understand better what are the challenges in their neighborhood and what are possible solutions.
So you named a couple of neighborhoods that are not potentially surprising to our listeners. Baby Hunters Point, Tenderloin is areas where this is particularly problematic. Were there any surprises in your study about the breadth of this problem or pockets where it might not be obvious?
I think that what has come is always a discussion for us, I think, in the Food Security Task Force is the challenge around seniors, people living on fixed income, people that may be homebound. They may not. They may have food pantries in their neighborhood. We have an amazing network of food pantries across the city. But for someone who may be disabled or is just hard time getting around and or going up hills or standing in lines, they may have a lack of access to those programs that are in their neighborhood. So I think that's one of the biggest concerns is the seniors. And then we also are starting to look more at the needs of families with children. We know that there is an underutilization of CalFresh in San Francisco, and we're really working, and the director of the CalFresh program of San Francisco is on our task force, so we're working hand-in-hand with him and his team to really understand where the opportunities to try to get more families signed up for CalFresh.
And CalFresh is what colloquially we termed as
food stamps.
Okay, just
yeah.
People understand that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll get back to dig into the barriers for each of those areas in a moment, but I want to turn to Hillary next to talk about the health implications, both direct and indirect, of such food insecurity. So Hillary, tell us about some research you've done and other research you know about that helps us understand the health implications of this problem.
The health implications of food insecurity among children have been understood and documented for decades. We know that hungry children get iron deficiency anemia and other nutritional deficiencies, and it's very clear from very old evidence that children are not able to reach their cognitive potential, their intellectual potential, and their educational potential if they're not being reliably fed. We are just in the last decade, I would say, starting to understand the health implications of food insecurity among adults. And the first thing we always think about is obesity, but it's also become very clear that other chronic diseases are associated with food insecurity, diseases like diabetes, potentially congestive heart failure, high blood pressure. These are all diseases that are very sensitive to the diet that you eat.
Are you saying that the diets create those problems or can make the management of those problems more difficult or both?
I think it's probably both, and emerging research is really shedding a light on this. What happens is that people are making choices in the short term in order to get enough calories to not feel the physical sensation of hunger. So pretend that you only had $5 a day to eat. What would you do? In the short term, as Eli suggested, you would buy shelf-stable, very calorically dense, very nutritionally poor foods because it keeps you from feeling hungry. And that is adaptive in the short term. The problem is when these behaviors are sustained year after year and decade after decade, and that is the story of food insecurity in this country, is people tend to be food insecure for years and years and years, then we see the health implications start to pile up from many, many decades worth of diets that are poor in nutrients and high in salt.
And my understanding is that more and more research is showing these days that it's really your sugar intake that is putting you at higher risk for developing diabetes, not necessarily just your weight. Is that right?
That is probably true. That is what the new evidence is showing. What is very clear in the U.S. is that among food insecure households, dietary intake of fruits and vegetables is low and dietary intake of processed sugar is high. And so it should come as no surprise then that people are at higher risk of obesity and diabetes. And what may be even more important is that once you develop obesity and diabetes, it is that much harder to control your illness, that much harder to prevent the complications of diabetes. And this is really important because it comes back to something Eli said. said earlier, which is about the trade-offs. Once you have diabetes and have started developing complications and you need to see the doctor more frequently and pay for special shoes and pay for blood sugar strips and all of the other out-of-healthcare costs that come with being sick, that puts additional pressures on your food budget. And people who get chronic disease tend to become food insecure if they weren't food insecure. And if they were food insecure, they tend to become more food insecure. And so we really have to stop this vicious cycle of health complications and food insecurity.
So what you're basically painting there is a picture that the problem then begets greater problems overall. What is, back to you, Paula, what are the long-term implications for our society from a health perspective? We talked a little bit about the individual here with Hillary's comments. What's the implications from a public health perspective of having such a high burden of individuals who are food insecure in any one jurisdiction?
Well, we definitely want to focus on prevention first. We want to focus on keeping people well. And so the more that we can focus on making sure that our residents all have access to healthy nutrition from the start, then we can start to hopefully prevent some of these illnesses, some of these chronic, like, vicious cycles that's happening with food insecurity and poverty. I think that we understand from our public health point of view that food insecurity is a problem. We've put it into our strategic plan and our population health division. So this is something that we're really paying attention to and really trying to figure out how can we alleviate food insecurity? How can we prevent it?
Mm. Hillary, you want to add there?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that from a public health perspective, the other thing we're thinking about is costs. We know that the costs of treating chronic disease like diabetes and its complications are extremely high. The costs of feeding people are likely to be much, much lower. And so from a public health perspective, I think we have to keep in mind how small investments up front can lead to huge savings down the line if we can prevent cases of diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, et cetera.
Eli.
And I just want to add, in addition to the health impacts, a great example beyond that is schools. So there's kids who are well-fed learn better. And so it's not just a public health impact, it's an educational impact. And if we're investing all this money in public schools, we need to ensure that students are ready to learn. And if students are hungry, they're not ready to learn.
And therefore, achievement gaps and so on and so forth, things that we've talked about that then lead to the income gap that we also often talk about. So food seems like a pretty key factor in this larger debate that we're having as a city. I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're talking about ways to combat food insecurity here in San Francisco with our guest, Dr. Paula Jones of the San Francisco Department of Public Health, Dr. Hillary Seligman of UCSF and the Center for Vulnerable Populations, and Eli Zegas of SPUR. What does SPUR stand for?
Used to be San Francisco Planning and Urban Research. Now we're just SPUR because we have offices in San Jose and soon in Oakland.
There we go. Thanks. It's time for you to join us with your questions and comments. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation this evening. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at the KALW website. So, Paula, I wanted to go back to you. Let's remind ourselves of what I term the health equation here, which is having enough resources to afford food, having access to that food nearby your neighborhood in an easy to get to way, and having the ways to prepare the food either by the facilities or the know-how, and I imagine storing the food, right? Because we've talked a lot about the going for the long shelf life food, which tends to be not as nutritionally advantageous. Those three areas, resources, access, and consumption, are the parts of the equation. Tell us in briefly barriers in each of these areas. And in the first area, resources, some people might say, well, there's food stamps and there's all these other programs. There's meal programs at St. Anthony's or Clyde or elsewhere around the city. Why is this such a problem?
So for the pillar of food resources, so financial resources for food, I mean, as Eli talked about, we have a very high cost of living. So we also have these federal nutrition programs, which are based on a standard federal poverty rate. And that is not adjusted to our local conditions. So we may have someone living in San Francisco that's just above the threshold where they would be income qualified for food stamps, but they're not qualified because they're making too much money to be qualified for this federal program, and they're living with very scarce resources in a city like San Francisco. So that's one of our challenges is these federal programs are not adjusted to the local cost of living. For access, like I said before, there may be food programs all around the neighborhoods, but there may not be adequate amounts. They may not be utilized. For example, the example I gave before was really there's many senior congregant meals. We as a city really support these programs through our charitable feeding system, through our city food programs. But for someone who may be disabled, they may actually have some money to purchase food, but maybe can't take the bus. Or if they do take the bus to the grocery store, they're not physically able to necessarily carry the groceries back home. So that's an access issue for that particular person. We also have a program that allows people who are homeless, disabled, or elderly and that are on food stamps to use their food stamp benefits at participating restaurants. But we don't have, some of those restaurants are mainly concentrated in the downtown area, and they may not be out in, say, the Sunset or OMI, and you may have somebody who could use that program at a restaurant if there was a participating restaurant in their neighborhood. And then for the consumption issue, we have many people living in single-room hotels that were never built with kitchens. If they do have community kitchens, they may be utilized, they may not be utilized. So we have many people living in housing units that do not have kitchens. And we also saw that from a report that was done on secondary units, so in-laws. And that was done several years ago by a group looking at the area around City College, that OMI area, and found that of their survey, about 10% of those in-laws also, people did not have access to cooking. So I think that this issue is actually broader than what we just notated from our census data in the Tenderloin Chinatown and the Mission area. I think that we've got people living in housing arrangements that may not give them access to kitchens.
Hmm. So it sounds like to review in the resources area, there's not just the resource, people have to qualify for the resource, right? And not everyone you think would qualify for the resource will.
Right.
And then the actual subsidy pales in comparison to the actual cost of living here. And then in the access question, I think there's what we will talk about a little bit more in a moment, which is the healthy corner stores transformation as a way to really change the issue of what used to be called food deserts, but now mm-hmm. I see is being called food swamps, and that's an interesting turn there. And then thirdly, as you're saying, that lots of people either don't know how to cook or don't have access to cooking facilities. I'm actually curious about that last one, Hillary. As you mentioned, people over time will be food insecure for long periods of time is what I meant to say. And does it get to a point where, you know, people forget or never learn healthy eating habits or healthy cooking habits because it was just never part of their life? And could you imagine a situation where that gets perpetuated over time?
Absolutely. And we know from many, many studies that there is a much greater lack of education about cooking than there has been in the past. Although I don't want to negate the fact that many people who are food insecure, and probably the majority of people who are food insecure, have incredible coping strategies and are able to use their budgets in really cost-effective and really in ways that are based on resilience and strategies that have been developed since their youth. But it is true that many fewer people cook nowadays, and it is cheaper to cook than it is to go out. And so this is a problem in food insecurity. And one of the reasons why we're very fortunate to live in San Francisco is that there are many community resources for cooking education and nutrition education as well. So any new food programs that we start in San Francisco are able to take advantage of the resources that already exist in that world.
So we have a couple of calls to get to, but I'm going to put the phone number out again, 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 if you want to join our conversation. Let's go first to Robert in San Francisco. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I want to comment, sort of a question, maybe it's a comment, on what seems to be an overemphasis on fresh vegetables versus frozen or canned. I've actually researched this, read articles. It seems that the studies are pretty clear that frozen vegetables, for the most part, are as healthy, or in some cases even healthier than fresh vegetables, because they're frozen at the right point. So you can eat them when they're at their freshest, essentially, and have the highest amount of nutrients. So if you're poor or come from a culture where you don't usually have fresh fruits and vegetables, one of the problems is you buy it and you leave it in the refrigerator, you don't cook it in time, it's gone, it's spoiled. So, but it's much easier if you have frozen vegetables, you throw them in the microwave, there's no loss because essentially you it's frozen and you when you're finally ready to eat it, you cook it. And it's easier to cook than fresh vegetables. I know those of us who are into vegetables think the fresh ones taste better, but people who aren't into them think the frozen ones taste just as good. So my question is, why not at least have some emphasis on frozen vegetables for people who have limited cooking facilities, who aren't familiar with vegetables, who are worried about spoilage and things like that?
Thank you so much, Robert. Hillary.
Robert, I think that's a great question, and thank you for bringing it up. As a physician, I 100% agree with you that frozen vegetables offer many, many nutrients, probably as many or more nutrients as fresh vegetables, and they're often cheaper because they are frozen when demand is low relative to supply, so they are always frozen in season. The counterpoint to that is canned fruits and vegetables. It's very challenging to find canned fruits or vegetables that don't have added sugar or salt. So as a physician, I recommend to my patients frozen fruits and vegetables to save money, but not canned. I will say in the context of affordability, though, that even frozen fruits are often out of range for people who are living on a very limited food budget. So on a CalFresh budget, for example, even affording frozen fruit is often very, very challenging.
So from a nutrition perspective, no difference, but from fresh versus frozen?
From my perspective, yes, it is a little bit controversial, but most people would agree with Robert.
Okay. All right. Let's go next to Carl from San Francisco. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question was, I was wondering what the kind of cost-benefit analysis shows, if it is possible to do it, for providing fresh food, which seems laudable, as opposed to providing drugs or, you know, pharmaceutical healthcare options for the client population. I'm guessing that a lot of this population is insulin dependent, and, you know, would money be better spent providing insulin or better spent providing sort of fresh carrots and fresh fruit and things like that?
Thanks so much for your call. So what do you say to Carl's question?
Well, there was an interesting study done a few years ago in Britain that showed that the cost of putting people on a statin medication for cholesterol would be less than feeding everybody an apple a day. And what I think we need to take away from that is not that we should be giving people statin medications rather than providing people with the opportunity to eat healthy foods. The problem then is that we wait until people are sick and we blow them off until they're sick, and then our healthcare costs will take care of them. So first of all, we have some perverse incentives here if apples cost more than statin medications. But second of all, I think the key point here is that if we invest in those apples up front, then we prevent the need for ever needing that statin medication down the line.
Right. So it's about when that intervention occurs.
Exactly.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation tonight here on City Visions on KALW San Francisco 91.7 FM as we talk about Ways to Battle Food Insecurity Here in San Francisco. That was Dr. Hillary Seligman, Associate Professor of Medicine at UCSF and the Center for Vulnerable Populations and an internist at San Francisco General Hospital. A little earlier, we heard from Eli Zegas, Food Systems and Urban Agriculture Program Manager at SPUR. And we also heard from Dr. Paula Jones. She's Senior Health Planner and Director of Food Systems at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Again, the phone number, 415-841-4134. You can also email us or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KALW website. Let's go next to Patricia from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Standing here in my kitchen, feeling very fortunate to be making my family a very good, nice dinner. And I wanted to let your listeners know that there is a program, and I don't know how it works, for schools to provide a free breakfast for everyone. At my son's school, Thomas Edison Charter Academy, every morning the children arrive at school and they sit at their desks. Usually they listen to music, chat quietly, and they have a healthy breakfast provided. And that's a K-8 school. And it's been, the teachers love it, the children love it, the parents love it. I don't know how you get it. I think it's through a federal grant. But that's how one small community school is attacking food insecurity for our student population.
Thanks very much, and have a good meal. Paula.
Thank you, Patricia. You're absolutely right. We have a federal safety net. One of the main pillars of that is the National School Lunch Program and the School Breakfast Program. And this is a program that all of the schools in San Francisco Public Schools offer the breakfast program. SFUSD is moving toward doing more pilots around breakfast in the classroom, just like Patricia's children have at Edison. And they are moving forward at also rolling out supper programs in the school district. So there's many programs that are federally funded. We do, it is, again, a situation where the costs locally are often more expensive in San Francisco. So our SFUSD Board of Education approves some general fund contribution toward these programs. But we do have breakfast in all schools. Some breakfast in the classroom pilots are going on to see how that they can take that to scale throughout the whole SFUSD public school system. And if others are at charter schools or at private schools, they are also eligible to participate in the National School Lunch Program.
Eli.
And I just want to add to that, one of the findings of our report is that local government, by bringing in more federal funds, that's one of the most cost-effective things they can do. So the school lunch program, food stamps, those are funded at the federal level, and there's a smaller amount at the local level. But because so much of it comes from the federal level, it's really about enrolling students in the program or enrolling families in CalFresh. If you're a local policymaker and you're thinking, how can we get more resources, federal programs are one of the best ways to do it.
And is there any advocacy to try to right-size those subsidies so that they match the cost of living of the municipality that is requesting them?
Yes. I mean, it's tough because increasing federal subsidies has to be done through the Farm Bill, usually, or the School Lunch Meal
Authorization.
The Child
Nutrition Act.
Yeah, Child Nutrition Act. So there's lots of advocacy at that level, though we've recently seen food stamps cut. And there's stuff we can do. There's funding we can do at the state and local level to supplement that. And I think there are advocates pushing for that. San Francisco invests in its school meal program above what we're getting from reimbursements. But it's difficult to do a big program at a local level. And so some of that advocacy has to happen at the federal level.
So while we're waiting for those federal wheels to turn, we're going to turn our attention in the second half hour of our program to initiatives to battle some of those barriers that you nicely laid out for us, Paula. And I want to welcome to the program at this point Stephen Tennis, and he's a SRO resident and a member of the Tenderloin Healthy Corner Store Coalition and a community activist in the Tenderloin. Stephen, you're joining us by phone. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us this evening. So tell us You're welcome. Tell us a little bit about the day-to-day experience of someone who lives in an SRO when it comes to navigating food, where they're going to get food, how they're going to deal with other parts of their lives, and how that gets prioritized.
Well, it depends on what type of food you might be speaking of. I mean, You've got Glide's, you've got St. Anthony's, that's hot food. However, at an SRO, a lot of people don't like to go there because of the lines. And there's issues about safety. There's a lot of fighting, drug use, so on and so forth, or there can be. So you find a lot of people would just rather stay home, which means the only access they have to food, basically, is corner markets / liquor stores. There's approximately 72 in the Tenderloin. And I work with Tenderloin Health Corner Store Coalition, and we surveyed about 72, of which 52 to 54 are participating in a program right now. And we do assessments, and we advise them on what foods they might want to get that would create a healthier environment or healthier choices for people at a greater range of fruits and vegetables at a cheaper price, hopefully an affordable price. And that's right there. That is the big issue, is trying to get good, healthy food, a variety of that, at a cost-effective price for people that live in SROs. And that's a challenge. That's a real challenge.
So tell us, you surveyed 72 corner stores, and how big is the Tenderloin? It's not that big, right? It's the most densely populated neighborhood in the city. 72 corner stores that, as you mentioned, / liquor stores. When you walked in there and proposed this idea of them expanding the array of foods, specifically healthier foods, fresh fruits and vegetables, what kind of reaction did you get?
Well, I mean, it was a mixed bag, but because 52 are participating, I mean, I'll let you know that the majority are for that. I mean, I think basically, initially, you'll get this, I don't know, because healthier food, I mean, what does that mean? And they automatically think, well, that we want them to stop selling alcohol or stop selling tobacco, which would be a great idea, but that's not going to happen.
That's not part of your pitch.
No. I mean, it would be nice to curtail the advertisement of alcohol, you know, and maybe eventually on down the road try to reduce the times that are for sale. But that's something way in the future. But no, we don't go in there because, I mean, the door would be slammed in our face. Mm-hmm. And our main thing is to get quality food at an inexpensive price and a larger range.
So, being sold. So tell us about that. So how do you advise these corner stores to break into that market? And aren't they concerned that they won't that food will stay on their shelves because the people who live in that neighborhood can't afford it?
Exactly. And that's been really a tough one to try to navigate through. But what you do, I mean, a lot of stores surprisingly will have some type of some bananas or some limes or some apples or something. But we noticed last year that when we started this, that, I mean, it seemed like they bought this stuff that was like a day or two from going bad. Now, I don't know about you or any of the listeners, but if I go into a market, whether it be Safeway or a corner market, if what I see being displayed isn't appetizing, I'm not going to buy it. And I don't think anyone is. And that is one of the things that we've really tried to stress with the store owners, that if you're going to stock something, don't have it look like it's a day or two from turning bad. It's not the necessarily initially, not the amount, but the quality. And if it looks good, people will buy it. We just finished a store called Rodman's, and that's basically 201 Turk Street. I mean, this is a model store. I mean, it was a good store to begin with, but after it was redone, he's got a meat market in there. He's got a produce section that is excellent. I mean, it's really something to see. So we are making inroads, and there are certain stores that you can go to where you can get quality food at a good price. I mean, we always wish that things could be cheaper. But unfortunately, because of where we live in San Francisco, the cost of living is such that it makes it really a real challenge.
So it sounds like you've been able to win over the vendors, the shop owners. What happens with the food once it leaves those stores? Because I imagine that the same issues of being able to refrigerate or prepare the food come up for people who live in SROs that typically don't have cooking facilities or have very limited access to cooking facilities or refrigeration facilities. How are you navigating that or helping people navigate that?
Well, I mean, I guess basically it all boils down to whether or not someone has a refrigerator, right? I mean, if you don't, and if your utensils are very limited, you're basically shopping daily, and that is not a good way to go financially. I mean, the more you buy, the cheaper it is, regardless of the amount. But if you're stuck with having to basically shop just on a day-to-day basis because you've got no way of storing it for more than a day, it makes it very difficult. Very, very difficult to be able to afford to eat a good food, to have a good diet, and have that daily. I mean, it's a very difficult challenge.
Mm-hmm. So, have you found ways to circumvent that problem, to get around it?
Well, one way, if the store owners, if we can get them collectively, a large number of them, to buy in bulk together, that would really drastically reduce the cost, and it would make it a lot easier for them to sell it at a dramatically less price, a cheaper price, rather than if each store owner buys on their own. So we're really trying to incorporate that, but there's a lot of logistics that goes into that, and we're hoping. We're really keeping our fingers crossed and really trying to get that going.
That's great. How are you going to get those other 20 or so stores to come on with your program?
Persistence. And I guess maybe, I don't want to say shame them, but make them understand that, hey, we're a community here. We're a different in a lot of ways, but we're all human beings. And we all have a stake in this area, the Tenderloin, in San Francisco, hell, in the world. But in the TL, we're all brothers and sisters. We all live together, and we should be helping one another. And I think it would go a long way insofar as food justice is concerned, that if everybody got on board and we were going in the same direction.
So that
I understand that you can make a profit selling wholesome food. You can make a profit selling fruits and vegetables.
Great. So I want to thank you, Stephen Tennis, SRO resident in the Tenderloin, member of the Tenderloin Healthy Corner Store Coalition, and a community activist in the Tenderloin. Thanks for sharing that perspective with us, and good luck in your pursuits. It sounds like you're doing a great job.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. We all do.
Thank you. Right. Have a good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So, Paula, that's a pretty striking example of what happens when residents take change into their own hands. Tell us a little bit more about the logistics of this from the side of the shop owners. How do they end up being able to afford how do they make the margin here work?
Well, first of all, the city authorized a program. Basically, this program working with corner stores was piloted out in Bayview Hunters Point. It was a group, the Food Guardians and the Southeast Food Access Working Group and Department of Public Health. That program was picked up and actually institutionalized through the Mayor's Office of Economic and Workforce Development. It's called Healthy Retail SF. And that's what the program that Stephen is participating in, and that is really looking to attract store owners that will accept assistance on looking at their business model, looking at the facade improvement, their redesign of their stores. There's community activists with the Tenderloin Corner Store Coalition, also the Food Guardians in Bayview, that are working hand-in-hand with the owners to stock healthier food, to display it better, and to also look at their business practices, their accounting practices, their the back end, basically to see how they can basically serve these foods, offer these foods, and make a profit of it. One thing that Stephen was talking about was this collective purchasing. I know this is something that my colleagues at Department of Public Health and OEWD are working on is there a way that the store owners can come together and do collaborative purchasing so that they can buy in bulk and lower the cost for themselves to purchase the food and also lower the cost that passed on to the consumers.
So I'm curious, why this route? Why go to the route of transforming the food access corner by corner, as it were, rather than trying to lure in a supermarket, let's say? Eli.
It's a great question, and they're not exclusive of each other. You can try and do both. And I think especially in the Tenderloin, if you talk to some of the staff at Office of Economic and Workforce Development, they tried. They've tried for years to attract a full grocery store into the neighborhood. And part of the difficulty is convincing them that there's enough of a market that they'll make a profit. But perhaps even larger for the Tenderloin specifically is there space for the building that a grocery store expects, the square footage? And for mainline grocery stores like Safeway, it's really difficult to find a spot where they could move in. In the Bayview, Fresh and Easy opened a few years ago. It's subsequently closed, and there's different store reasons behind that. But in a neighborhood when you can't easily attract a grocery store, corner stores is where people are shopping often for food and other supplies, and so you might as well meet people where they are.
And do you feel like that you can create the scale that you need by stocking this corner stores?
You know, I think there is a study being done right now to look at what is the number of vendors that would be needed and the volume of purchasing that would be needed to actually have a viable business model for somebody to actually come in and do the purchasing for the stores and stock the stores too. So some of my colleagues are looking at that right now, and I do not know the results of that study.
So it's sort of transforming the business model, doing a makeover of the corner store. Yes, Eli.
And one thing I want to add to that is that we've talked a lot about the supply side, so the store owner making changes. But a big factor is the demand side, and that's both preferences. Do people want fresh food? Do they want fruits and vegetables or otherwise? But it's also the affordability again. Do right. they want to buy it? And right. I think that's gets to the core of what Hillary's been working on.
You know, I'm looking for a new co-host. No, just kidding. No, Eli, you're perfect there, because, in fact, Hillary was waiting very patiently, because I wanted to unpack this issue of access, but then how are people actually going to afford it? So this is where EatSF and the program you're starting, Hillary, it comes in. So tell us about EatSF and how it's getting at this issue of resources for people to be able to afford the foods that we're trying to bring into these neighborhoods.
Well, the EatSF program's vision is that all low-income San Francisco residents in all neighborhoods will have access to fruits and vegetables at the market where they regularly shop. And one of the models that's been tested nationwide, and which we're very fortunate to be able to implement in San Francisco with the lead support of the Hellman Collaborative Change Initiative, is this EatSF program, which is essentially a voucher which a low-income household would receive weekly, and which is redeemable at their local corner store or local full-service grocery store for fresh or frozen fruits and vegetables. And the goals of this program are twofold. One is that participants will increase their dietary intake of fruits and vegetables and thereby reap health benefits down the line. But the second, and equally as important goal, as Eli and Paula referred to, is that community food vendors will be able to increase the availability of fresh and frozen fruits and vegetables in response to neighborhood demand. And much of that demand, given the challenges with affordability of these foods in the neighborhood, will be generated by these EatSF vouchers.
So tell us about how something like that would work.
Well, vouchers will be distributed to select low-income households initially in the form of a paper voucher, which will be accepted initially at corner stores in the Tenderloin neighborhood for any fresh or frozen fruits or vegetables. And the cost of that program will be sustained by the EatSF program, funded by the Hellman Collaborative Change Initiative. And the vision is that people will receive these vouchers every week for a full year. Why for a full year? Because we know that it takes for a full year for for people to really change their shopping and eating habits. We don't want 6 or 8 weeks and then people go back to doing what they usually do. We want to really support these corner grocery stores and their ability to stock fruits and vegetables and really allow people the opportunity to change their shopping and eating practices.
And what's your long-range plan for sustainability? How do you, this is kind of a pilot, I imagine, right? How do you help people to be able to sustain these practices when the funding from a foundation such as the Hellman Foundation goes away?
Mm-hmm. There are many ways to make fruit and vegetable consumption more affordable. The first thing we have to do is to convince people to eat them again, to try them again, to risk buying a head of broccoli for their family and know that their family is going to eat it, so it's not such a risk to go out on a limb and purchase that head of broccoli. So we want to create those changes. We are always looking for additional donations for people who want to fund additional vouchers. People are welcome to contact me if they're interested in that. We will be going deep into the Tenderloin neighborhood to really support that neighborhood and then expanding to Bayview Hunters Point, to OMI and other neighborhoods across the city with the hopes that by 2015, vendors will be available across the entire city who accept the Eat SF voucher and will be able to distribute these vouchers to people throughout the entire city if they need them to afford nutritious foods for themselves and their families.
Mm. And Paula, do you see this as something that the city will want to put some money towards for the long term if successful?
Well, I definitely think that part of Hillary's program, the Eat SF program, is going to be evaluating the health impacts on the participants. So she, I believe, is looking to really distribute these vouchers to low-income adults with chronic diseases or possibly low-income families and really measure the health impacts on those families and those individuals. And I think with that, we'll have more information to be able to go back to, you know, our departments, go back to city officials, and really present the information in that way. This was something that was presented during the Food Security Task Force hearing, and that was back in November of last year, and this was something that certain members of the city family were very interested in, and we definitely, I know Hillary is going to be in contact and keeping all of those people informed of what the research is showing.
And it seems like this innovation is a workaround for what federal subsidies can't provide. Ultimately, though, going back to the question I posed earlier, Eli, are programs like this going to help provide a head of steam, so to speak, to get ahead of some of the delays in or lack of movement on the federal level to really rethink access and resources to healthy foods?
I think right now you're right. Our current subsidy programs aren't sufficient for the need. And short-term, mid-term, we need to be looking at increasing those subsidies at the federal level, at the state level, at the local level. Long-term, in a more perfect world, we would figure out ways to address income inequality so people wouldn't need subsidies, that they could afford it, they could be self-sufficient. That's a long way off, and it's not the way we're trending. And I think what we're hoping to see from programs like Hillary's and then other programs we're seeing nationwide is demonstrating the value and making the case that we need more public funds because it's a worthwhile investment up front to save money later on.
Hillary, you wanted to add something there?
Yeah, we know from USDA studies of the food stamp, now called the SNAP program, that $1 spent in food stamps generates between $1.70 and $1.84 in local economic activity. So we know these programs are good for spurring economic growth, and in particular, they are good for spurring economic growth in those low-income neighborhoods, which particularly need those funds invested. And so in many ways, this is a win-win situation because it's bringing money in targeted ways to those communities and those small businesses that really need the support in order to transform themselves into places where healthy foods can be distributed.
Paula?
Yeah, I would just only add that this Eat SF program is really engaging in a national conversation. I think it's becoming much more well understood nationally that lack of resources impacts people's diet. That's impacting their health. We've seen the USDA, which is the administrator of the food stamp program, do a pilot on what would it take to add a few more dollars onto people's benefits level so that they can purchase fruit and vegetable. That now has turned into a national grant program. They're accepting grant applications right now, and that is really would focus on increasing the purchasing power of our food stamp recipients. One of our challenges in San Francisco and in California in general is that many people who are low income on SSI or SSP are just not eligible for food stamps in the state of California.
So people who are disabled are actually not able to afford food stamps in the first place. So there's that gap that we were talking about earlier where a program like yours, Hillary's, the EDSF, would help fill that need. So let's go to a caller, Cindy from San Leandro.
Hi.
We have less than 5 minutes in the program, so can you make some brief comments?
I'll make it very, very brief, but very, very positive. I'm so excited to hear about the work that you're doing. I used to work for Department of Public Health. I did so for 19 years and did many, many home visits in the city, in the Tenderloin, in Chinatown, in the Mission, and I witnessed amazing resilience and amazing creativity on the part of many families putting together meals with the food that they could get. There's lots of different departments within Department of Public Health that are doing many home visits, and I can tell you that there are so many families that would benefit so much by what you're proposing, what you're getting together to allow these families to have access to food, because they cook with fresh vegetables, rice, beans, and fresh veggies, and they would love this extra help. So thank you very much for all the work that you're doing.
Thanks so much, Cindy, for your call. So, Paula, we didn't get to the last pillar, which was consumption. What's happening there in terms of helping people to expand ability to store and cook and learn how to cook foods in the environments that they live in?
That's a great question. Thank you. The Food Security Task Force has really grappled with this issue for a while, and what we have we're engaging in is actually a food assessment of SRO residents. Hillary and I and our colleague Karen Groneisen from Episcopal Community Services has been working on this as well as other members. What we've done is actually surveyed over 600 SRO residents. We're really assessing for their food security status, their nutrition risk, their access to cooking, and their desire to cook, and their priorities for improving food security. So we do have all the data in. It hasn't been analyzed, but that will be next on what we will be presenting to the community, to the elected officials, because we wanted to find out from the SRO residents exactly what their priorities were.
And are there cookbooks out there on how to use a crock pot in an SRO, for example?
There's definitely great groups working with people teaching how to cook. There's the Ames Project that's part of Department of Public Health, the next course. We've got Leah's Pantry, which is really doing a lot of cooking classes. We have many other groups. I don't want to leave any out, but we definitely have a lot of groups working on teaching how to cook, teaching how to shop, and giving actually even utensils for cooking. A whole kit would go to some people.
Great. Eli, when is the SPUR report coming out?
Should be out by the start of February.
And where can people find out about it?
SPUR.org, SPUR.org.
And Paula, where can people learn about all of the various programs of the San Francisco Department of Public Health when it comes to food security?
Well, we have a website. It's on the DPH website, www.dph.org/food security. And that is all of our information from the Food Security Task Force.
And Hillary, where can people, we actually got a caller who wanted to know more about EDSF. I imagine either to learn more about the program or perhaps to donate to it. How can people learn more about that?
We will shortly have our website up and running. In the meantime, anybody who's interested in learning more or, of course, in actually purchasing fresh fruits and vegetables through these voucher programs to give to a low-income resident should email me, Hillary, Hillary.Seligman, Seligman, at UCSF.edu.
And if there's a retailer, a corner store that wants to become a newly minted corner store, where do they go?
They would go to Healthy Retail SF. And that is a website on the Office of Economic and Workforce Development.
Okay. And we'll put links to all of those websites on our website. So that's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Paula Jones of the San Francisco Department of Public Health, Dr. Hillary Seligman of UCSF and the Center for Vulnerable Populations at San Francisco General Hospital, and Eli Zegas of SPUR. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance, and tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Our senior producer is Susie Britton. Join my co-host David Onick next Monday as we discuss the future of higher education with the founding dean of Minerva. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week. We'll be right back.